third case, Liu versus Ashcroft.
Moss,
I welcome you back to the Seventh Circuit. Have you made an appearance since you've left the circuit some time ago?
As a private citizen, this is my first. Thank you. Good morning. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Co-Counsel, Mr. Ragland. Case today involves the plight of Meidan Liu, who, at the age of 16 in her native country, China, was selling books in a park. Some of these books were given to her by a neighbor and happened to be attributable in some form or another, they may have been pamphlets, to the Falun Gong movement, which I'm sure you're aware is an outlawed spiritual movement in China. She was arrested, mistreated, detained, jailed for 2 days. Her parents paid an exorbitant sum to get her out of jail.
But Mr. Moss, I'll get right to the point because
sure.
This is obviously a short time. Number one, frankly, as BIA opinions go, this one is a relatively complete treatment of her case. And so I read this really as the opinion, not as simply something that supplements the IJ. And more than that, it really seems to me that here the BIA has said that the incidents, even if we credit her absolutely, hypothetically, you know, as we would do, it says we find these incidents cumulatively do not rise to the level of persecution. And we know that there's this practically Talmudic distinction between mere harassment on the one side, which nobody condones, but it's harassment, and actual persecution on the other side, which satisfies
Correct.
The statute.
Correct.
Now, it seems to me we owe deference to that finding, and this isn't Falun Gong as a general matter. This is what happened to this particular applicant. How can we find that it was wrong to characterize this harassment she suffered as actual persecution?
Well, for several reasons. First of all, you're right. This is a much better reasoned opinion than you see normally from the BIA. On the other hand, they did not consider all the evidence. Recall that the claim for asylum is based on two essential factors, an objective and a subjective factor. The objective factor is an objective analysis. You know, did persecution occur or is it likely to occur in the future? The subjective analysis is, does the petitioner hold a well-founded fear of future persecution?
Right, and suppose she does. I mean, it seems to me objectively what we have is the arrest, the fine, the detention for a couple of days, they pull her hair, throw her down on the floor, and later ransack her house without arresting her. Expel her from high school. Cumulatively, not great things to happen to you, but when you see how truly awful things have to be before the courts find persecution, mm-hmm. why does this add up to persecution?
We would submit for one principal reason. The fact is that this is a 16-year-old girl. I mean, we're not talking about an adult here. This is a 16-year-old girl, and I think that it's important to understand what difference that makes as opposed to the fact that she were just an ordinary adult. For example, there is evidence in the record, and the ground, and the standard review here, of course, is substantial evidence on the record as a whole. And in that record, there is a lot of information, for example, about how her parents were victims of persecution. You know, this girl had never left home. This is not a person who necessarily is, you know, for example, very worldly in her ways. And I don't mean to speak that poorly about my client in this respect. But what I'm saying here is that we're talking about somebody, you know, who is probably exceptionally vulnerable as opposed to, you know, an average person. And granted that, you know, bad things happen to people every day in other countries. And the asylum laws do not make amends for all of them. We only do take certain exceptional cases. But I think it's telling in this respect that, you know, this girl's parents upon this happening to her, took out, I mean, what the record suggests is that they took out large loans to help her flee the country alone, without even coming with her. Sent her off unaccompanied to, you know, a foreign land. In fact, she went through a number of foreign lands, a two-month journey to arrive here in the United States, going through a series of handlers. They must have been aware of the risks that she faced doing so. And I think that what the parents thought clearly speaks as to, you know, sort of the dangers that this girl faced. I don't think that, you know, such a, you know, potentially reckless act, considering the type of things that happen to children in the world, would be taken so lightly. So I think that's an important thing to recognize. I think another important thing about the BIA's particular order in this case is that the BIA simply didn't consider the realm of evidence. It didn't take her age into account in the subjective analysis. It didn't even mention her age. It doesn't mention how old she was when this incident happened. And I would point out that she was still a minor when she proceeded through the Immigration Court and the Board of Immigration Appeals in this case.
They do acknowledge the expulsion from school.
Right.
I don't know how much we can take from that.
And granted, that's correct. I mean, she was the equivalent of a junior in high school, I imagine, by our standards. And what effect that would have on her is obviously an open question that's not necessarily answered by the cold facts that appear in the papers in this case. But, of course, it was something that the BIA didn't take into account either. And I think that for an American, say, high school student, this might sound like a fairly minor infraction. Obviously, it would be unimaginable in our country, I would hope, but for this type of incident to occur. But on the other hand, expulsion from high school is a fairly significant thing, is fairly significant. I also think that the BIA order in this case can't really effectively be addressed without some reference to what the immigration judge did. And I think that that is important because we submit that the immigration judge, denied relief on credibility grounds only, did not at all provide, say, an alternative analysis of the merits of Maydan's claims. But on the other hand, the judge did purport to find certain facts that occurred, and some of which were simply not relevant to the analysis. And the BIA does appear to have sort of at least partially hung its hat on those as a
whole. Which facts? I mean, because there's this paragraph at the top of page 2 of the BIA's opinion
Right. Where
it reads to me as though the BIA is giving her the benefit of the doubt and not going
mm-hmm.
with the IJ's rather outrageous and otherworldly opinion of what happens to 16-year-olds in China. But as long as the BIA has fixed it, they're the agency who we're technically reviewing.
And granted, I mean, the BIA did say that that's what it was purporting to do. It said, you know, on the first page, it says, even if we accept her testimony as true, we find that, you know, she didn't... that these facts taken alone do not, or maybe harassment, but not raise the level of persecution. But there's still certain facts missing from this. One is her age. And
what does the BIA say that's actually wrong, that matter that relies on the IJ?
As a matter of fact, the BIA mentions, for example, that no similar harm came to Maydan's neighbor despite the fact that she was a follower of Falun Gong. There's nothing in the record that suggests that the neighbor was a follower of Falun Gong. The neighbor had these books. Maybe she knew about it. In fact, what the neighbor said, according to, and this is largely in the records to be found in the exhibits to the application for asylum, and also in the BIA brief. And we
so
pointed
she didn't
out
testify that the neighbor was an actual follower?
No, she did not. There's nothing in there, and we cited the pages of transcript and brief. And in the reply brief as well, that cite that. There's nothing in the suggest the neighbor was there. The neighbor wasn't arrested because the neighbor admitted in a letter that she wrote to the immigration judge that she ran away. In fact, our client testified to the exact same fact. We don't know what happened to the neighbor. The neighbor's statements are somewhat ambiguous. But on the other hand, it simply didn't happen according to what this record says. And so that fact is just wrong. Whether something happens to the neighbor or not is frankly just irrelevant to what happened to our client, as you mentioned. I see I'm starting to enter into my rebuttal time, so I'd like to reserve that if I'm going to...
Thank you, Mr. Moss.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Ragland.
morning, Your Honor. Thomas Ragland for the respondent, John Ashcroft. Your Honor, the court's jurisdiction in this case is limited. Initially, I would point out the court's jurisdiction is limited, as Your Honor has recognized, to the BIA, to the board's decision in this case.
But I have to ask you something, Mr. Ragland. I find this case, wholly apart from, obviously, the fact that we're reviewing the BIA's opinion and so forth, absolutely outrageous. From the IJ's blithe assumption that minors in China are treated the same way minors would be treated here, to the fact that this young lady appears to have been shackled in the detention facility that she was in, what is this government doing?
Your Honor, that's correct. It was a policy at that time under the INS, which, as you know, is
right,
no longer
the Homeland Security, we know that.
That with adults, it was the INS policy at that time that with adult individuals, and they assumed at that time that she was
so an
adult.
So an 18-year-old girl who is already in a detention facility is going to be shackled? This is what our government is doing to people?
That, Your Honor, that was the policy at that time that she entered the United States, and she was in secondary inspection at O'Hare.
Unbelievable, all I can say. Something utterly unnecessary, I would say. Once you, I certainly understand detention, no detention, one can make a rational decision. Shackling? But anyway, what's your response to Mr. Moss's point that the careless assumptions are being made, for example, about what the neighbor did? That she didn't testify that the neighbor was an actual follower of Falun Gong. B, that the neighbor, that we know something about what happened to the neighbor when in fact we don't.
Well, Your Honor, the petitioner was asked if anything had happened to the neighbor during the testimony, and was asked, was the neighbor imprisoned? And she said no, and was asked, do you know whether the neighbor was tortured? And she said, I don't know. I think the basis of the board's statement was questioning of the petitioner during the hearing, did anything happen to the neighbor? Was the neighbor ever arrested? Was her house ransacked? And the petitioner stated that she was not, to her knowledge.
So, I don't know turns into was never harmed despite her involvement in the book sales.
According to the testimony that we have, which is the extent of the evidence.
But that's not evidence. When somebody says, I don't know, A happened, and there's no other evidence in the record that would tend to prove that A did or didn't happen. How does I don't know that A happened turn into evidence in the record that A did happen?
Your Honor, I think the board's statement was based on an affirmative statement by a petitioner when she was asked, was the neighbor ever imprisoned? And she stated no, that she was not.
Now, you would have been objecting if that had been against you, given the fact that she wasn't even in China and would have had no way of knowing what happened to the neighbor. I mean, I could testify about whether I thought the neighbor was imprisoned, and it wouldn't be worth too much, would it?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, contrary to what the immigration judge did, the board accepted all of the petitioner's testimony as credible and granted her testimony, and also the judge, over the objections of the INS, admitted the documentary evidence that she submitted, the letter from the neighbor, the letter from her mother, the arrest warrant, other things that the INS had objected to because they were not properly certified under the regulations and they had not been authenticated. So all of that evidence was accepted by the BIA, and what the board said was, even if we accept all that evidence, even if we accept all of her testimony as credible, she has not presented sufficient evidence to demonstrate either that she was persecuted in the past under the high standard for persecution that Your Honor mentioned, or that she has a well-founded fear of being persecuted in the future. And it's that opinion which the court is examining. And again, the standard under which the court examines that opinion is substantial evidence, and that is to determine whether the board's decision is supported by reasonable, substantial, and probative evidence when reviewing the record as a whole. I would submit, Your Honor, that in this case, it is. That this is not a case where no reasonable fact finder that a reasonable fact finder would be compelled to find that the evidence rises to the level of meriting asylum. Now, Your Honor, the other issue that petitioner raised regarding the absence of a discussion of the age of the petitioner in their decision. Initially, I would say that there's no obligation in the regulation or in the statute that the board provide a specific articulation in its decision. In this case, unlike some other cases that have been discussed by this court in recent decisions, the board provided a fairly thorough analysis of the petitioner's case. It laid out the central aspects of her asylum claim, and it mentioned that she had been arrested, that she'd been detained, the harm she had alleged, the home invasion, and her expulsion from school. The board is not required to present an exegesis on everything that the petitioner raises. In this case, it does indicate that the board heard and thought and did not merely react as this court required. So the omission of a discussion of petitioner's age cannot be shown to be so relevant, and the petitioner has not shown that it prejudiced her in any way.
Well, it would be relevant if there were a rule that says people who are minors are entitled to have, let's say, a broader range of evidence considered, or if there is something specific to minors. If the board doesn't appear to know she was a minor, you don't know.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. And also, Petitioner's counsel has submitted the guidelines on juvenile asylum claims, and those do provide guidance. However, they are not binding on the board or on the immigration judges. And also, the petitioner failed to show that her case would have resulted in a different conclusion had her age been considered. That what the board determined was not persecution, that was mere harassment, would have been transformed into the level of actual persecution. And absent showing prejudice, it's hard to see where the omission of the discussion of her age affects the outcome of this case. The other point I'd just like to raise is that Petitioner's counsel has submitted some argument regarding recent Seventh Circuit decisions that have discussed BIA opinions, and I would just say that, again, this case is distinguishable from those opinions. Kukshenkov, Niam, Blagoev, and Dimitrov, in all those cases, the court castigated the board for issuing either summary affirmances of inadequate immigration judge decisions or failing to provide sufficient analysis, providing perfunctory opinions that failed to provide the court sufficient guidance. In this case, the board provided a fairly thorough analysis. It discussed the central elements of her claim, and it came to a reasoned decision that this court, I believe, should affirm. It's supported by reasonable, substantial, and probative evidence, and unless Your Honor have further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Moss. Mr. Moss, assuming the board read the decision of the immigration judge, it does start out the first sentence that the respondent is a 17-year-old single female, and at the conclusion of that first sentence speaks to the arresting date of, or the entry date at O'Hare of 02. Page carries with it the date of the decision, May 03. Any reasonable reader, and the board knows when it's sitting, because I didn't take note of that, would know from the facts, if you just back that up a few months, the age that they were dealing with. I'm not speaking to whether there should or shouldn't be a different approach to minors, but isn't it pretty implicit in a fair reading of this that you're dealing with somebody who was 16 at the time?
We would submit that that's not apparent from the BIA's order.
You're
right. BIA does point that out. I think that the BIA typically...
Yeah, but the immigration judge starts out his decision with the respondent, a 17-year-old single female native of People's Republic of China.
He does. But on the other hand, you know, many of his, say, credibility determinations, which are sort of factual determinations, you know, really took her to task for exercising what he thought was poor judgment. He did, the immigration judge, just as an example, did point out, you know, that she was of college age or high school age. Actually, he said she was of college age, which was wrong, and surmised that maybe she was coming here to attend college, which, considering that she had testified that she'd been expelled from high school, was kind of you know, preposterous, to put it lightly.
Well, I just meant, but, speaking to the point of an awareness by the board of whether they had someone before them who just, at the time of the incident, clearly was a teenager. I mean, that seems self-evident. I don't. It's hard to charge them with an oversight. Maybe charging them with not focusing more on how to handle someone that age, but to it logically just seems to dictate they knew they were dealing with someone in their mid-teens.
But I don't see where that factored into the analysis. And just to, I'm sorry, I'm running into my red light here. But there is a subjective element to the asylum analysis. You know, the Supreme Court just on Tuesday mentioned that age and experience are factors in the subjective analysis in the Yarbrough decision. Although that wasn't obviously an issue in that case, the Sixth Circuit just on
well, it was a big issue.
Sorry?
That was a big issue in that case.
It was a big issue. I mean, you know, granted, Miranda is an objective analysis only, and that's what the court held. But it did discuss, albeit in dicta, you know, how age and experience and education, et cetera, are part and parcel of its subjective analysis. The Sixth Circuit, just a couple of weeks ago, in a case granted with a 9-year-old, not a 16-year-old, did take the guidelines that Mr. Raglan mentioned to heart, and without saying grafting them onto the asylum statute as Congress has written it, did say, you know, that those guidelines provide guidance and they should inform the subjective analysis, you know, as it's going to be taken in these asylum cases. And I just I would submit that is just not apparent from the BIA's order, even though it may have recited
so
that.
You would say we should look to some analysis, but not to a bright line. You're not suggesting, are you, Mr. Moss, that there's some arbitrary age at which the BIA should presume no mature status for the purposes of the analysis?
No, I mean, obviously a 9-year-old child is probably somewhat unusual for having an asylum claim that is not derivative of their parents' claim, which is what happened in the Abay case. And as far as I know, that's the only instance of a child that young that I could find. Perhaps the guidelines as written by the former INS, which are fairly reflective of what the United Nations has written, what Canada has written, what many other nations have written, do set an arbitrary cutoff at the age of 18, just like American law does. And many aspects of American jurisprudence are highly dependent on age. I mean, contracts, tort, obviously there are different rules that apply in different jurisdictions, but at some point there is an arbitrary cutoff, and we usually consider that to be the age of majority as opposed to minority, and there might be something in between. Our client was 16 when this happened, 17 when she went through the system. She was very close to the age of majority, and we're not arguing today that she should be treated like a 9-year-old. But on the other hand, we do think, considering her particular circumstances, what happened to her, where she's from, her age and experience, those are all factors that should have been taken into account both by the Immigration Court and the Board of Immigration Appeals.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Raglan. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed.